Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
And welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. After he graduated from Boston College in 1968, Bob Ryan started working at the Boston Globe as an intern. He stayed with the paper for the next 4.5 decades, becoming one of the country's best-known sports writers.
And over those years, he's covered the best and worst of times for Boston's teams, from Larry Bird's best years with the Celtics to the Red Sox epic collapses to their long-awaited World Series victories. He covered college basketball, the Stanley Cup, NASCAR, 11 Olympics, and he even wrote about an Ultimate Fighting Championship.
Yeah, and I want to hear about that. And he's written as well a slew of books on sports. His latest is a memoir. It's called Scribe, My Life in Sports, and Bob Ryan is with us. Welcome back to Radio Boston. It's great to see you in here, Bob.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, it's a real pleasure, and this book is so much fun. And I want to invite listeners to call in if you have a question for Bob Ryan about anything from the universe of sports. Give us a call at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Bob, I love the way you begin this memoir, and it becomes clear that it seemed like you were always destined to be a sports writer. You wrote your first sports column at the tender age of 11, I read.
Yes.
So tell us about the Sportster.
I was a good kid with words as well as a lover of sports. The two things I like most in the world were watching sports and reading.
Yeah.
I was a great reader. And and when you read, you naturally at some point want to write. It is a natural progression. And at age 11, I decided I would try out, after reading all these endless newspaper accounts of basketball, of sports events, a little column. And we called it the Sports Store. I typed it up on our typewriter. And what it basically consisted of was my overview of the 1956-57 Mercer County Parochial Basketball League that I happened to play in for St. Joseph's School, and then ended up with a few big-time observations, including one about the Celtics, and I said that Bob Cousy quarterbacks this club masterfully. Little did I know I would become well acquainted with Mr. Basketball as a Boston College student, but that was my first attempt at writing.
It's amazing. Was there ever a doubt, I mean, between that time and till you got to college and ended up interning at the Globe, did you always know that this is where you wanted to go?
I thought I would want, yes, the answer is I wanted to, but I honestly didn't know that how it would transpire, or
yeah,
whether you'd get a job, or what kind of career path it would be. That part went right through into March of my senior year. I did not know what was going to happen. At that point, I was 1A in the draft and did not have a job prospect coming out of school, and did not know really what was going to happen. And then in relatively short order, I lucked into an interview for a Globe internship, was accepted in the program, and then enlisted in the Army Reserve in beginning of May of 1968. And so my next year and a half or so were set. I was going to work at the Globe. I was going to go in and do active duty, and then hopefully I would come back to the Globe, which is the way it transpired.
Mm. Well, there's so much great writing and so many great stories in this book about the Celtics, about the Red Sox, about all kinds of... And let me start with the Celtics, because I know basketball, of course, is... it's hard to say is your passion, because you seem so passionate about everything, but I know that the NBA is a particular passion. So I want to ask you about this great story that comes from your book, the dramatic announcement by Celtics great Dave Cowens that he was retiring. So that was dramatic enough, but it was made especially dramatic to you because he delivered his retirement letter to you. And you call this pretty great preparation to be a sports writer.
Well, it was a singular day. I didn't know for sure there would ever be a book, but I knew that if there ever was to be a book, that I would start it with that event, thinking that this is my trump card in advance. I can't top this. This is the most amazing event that any sports writer would probably have, which is a future Hall of Fame player deciding to end his career by seeking your counsel as a writer, and by announcing his retirement in your hotel room and asking you to help edit his retirement statement.
Right.
I think this is my story alone. I don't know that anyone else has anything to match that one.
I mean, there's so many great details on stories. At one point, he says to you, do you mind if I call Red Auerbach, right?
Oh, the funny part is we go through this. He's standing in the doorway, and I invite him in, and what's going on? He's holding these pieces of a yellow legal pad paper as well as some typewritten stuff. And I start to read it, and it's a retirement statement. And I said, what do you want from me? He said, well, I'd like you to kind of put it in order, and I'd also like to make sure you get it into the paper. I said, well, I can certainly take care of the first one, and I'll certainly take care of the second one. Give me about an hour or so where I can let me look at this and see what I can do, what I need to be done, which really wasn't a whole lot. And on the way out the door, he turns around and says, do you mind if I call Red first? And so he sits down and calls Red Auerbach from my phone in my room at the hotel in Terre Haute, Indiana. And the conversation was very brief. It's like this. It says, hello, Mary being Mary Faraday, Red's secretary. It's Dave. May I talk to Red? Oh, Red, it's Dave. Remember what we talked about a couple of days ago? Well, I'm doing it. Okay, I'll see you when I get back. Click. That was it.
The end of the Dave Cowens era. Something else I'd like to ask you about the Celtics. You wrote this about the great Larry Bird. In my career, I have written more words about Larry Bird than any other individual. I couldn't possibly tell you who's in second place, but Larry is surely in first place. So, I'd love for someone who's poorly schooled in the finer points of basketball, how do you describe the way Larry Bird played and what he meant to the game?
He was a microcosm, in my view, of everything that's beautiful and laudable about the sport. Not the greatest athlete. He was famous for not being a great jumper or a fast runner, but he mastered the game. He figured out the essence of basketball. It doesn't have to do with jumping. It doesn't have to do with being an Olympic sprinter. It has to do with knowing how to play this game. He was gifted at 6'9" to be big enough to be able to bring a lot to the table. Were he 6'5", it would have been an entirely different story. There would be no Larry Bird as we know him, but he happened to be 6'9", which enabled him to rebound, see the floor better, to pass, and shoot over people, and therefore play the game to the maximum of his other abilities. He had, but as people talk about athleticism, they talk about running and jumping, but he had hand-eye coordination that was extraordinary. He had ambidexterity to the max. He's a natural left-hander. He does everything left-handed except shoot a basketball. He eats, he writes left-handed. He's not alone in this. Brooks Robinson was like this. Hmm. Danny Ainge is like this. I think if we explored sports, we'd find many more like this. It seems to be an advantage to have that kind of the natural lefty who can adapt himself to being a righty. So he had this, he brought that, and he brought a mind, a computer brain for the game of basketball to the floor, and he also had competitiveness, determination, all the yada yada, all those intangibles, all encompassed in this one body, and that's what Larry Bird brought to the game. He could see the floor, he could shoot, pass, rebound, and he was a step ahead of people and seeing what's going to happen on the floor. And obviously, I'd never seen anything like it.
Yeah, in fact, with regard to that, you have this great description of seeing him, I think for the first time, when he was a young college player at Indiana State. He was playing in an NIT tournament. And you saw him do something, and you looked at your fellow sports writer and said, did he really just do that?
That's correct.
What did he do?
What he did was this. He got a rebound. It was the first possession of the game. Illinois State shot and missed. He got the rebound. He dribbled the ball up the left-hand side of the floor, and then about two or three steps before he got to midcourt, off the dribble, he rocked back the ball into his right hand and fired an underhand bullet pass about 40 feet on a line to a cutting guard named Carl Nix for a layup. Oh. Off the dribble, spontaneously. I'd never seen a pass like this. Even the great Bob Cousy, I'm sure in his day, would have been very, very proud to acclaim that as his own. But that was a 6'9" guy who people thought of maybe in the outside world as a shooter, whose real great passion was passing. Had just thrown one of the most extraordinary passes I ever saw. This in the first 15 seconds of the game, on the first look that the three of us had. It was Jason Stark, who now people know is a baseball writer for ESPN.com, and Mike Madden, who later went to the Providence Journal and then became a columnist for the Boston Globe. They're both friends of mine. We had driven out together to see this game from Indianapolis.
Wow. Well, I want to move on because there's so much else to talk about. I want to talk to you about the Red Sox, beginning with the 1967 team that went on to the World Series against the Cardinals, Carl Yastrzemski, Jim Lomborg, George Scott, the Impossible Dream Team, of course. Let's listen to a moment from the final game of the regular season at Fenway Park.
Little soft pop-up. Petrucelli will take it. He does! The ball game is over! The Red Sox win it! And what a mob on this field! They're coming out of the stands from all over! They're just mobbing.
And of course, actually, what's interesting about that bit of tape, they hadn't won yet, right?
No,
they had to go back to the dugout and wait for the doubleheader.
A couple of hours.
Yeah.
A different world then. There were doubleheaders. And the fact that the situation was on the last day of the season, they had they were in a tie with Minnesota, but Detroit was also in the race, and Detroit was playing a doubleheader in against the Angels in Detroit. Due to rainouts, they had a doubleheader on Saturday and Sunday. The Red Sox win their game, and now they are sitting around in the clubhouse. This is pre-cable TV. But they did have the game radio on WHDH 850 patched in. They patched in the broadcast from Detroit.
Wow.
And they sat and waited to find out what their fate was going to be. If Detroit had won the game, there would have been a playoff game in Boston the following day, Monday, at Fenway Park.
Yeah.
But if Detroit loses the game, the Red Sox have won the pennant for the first time since 1946. Detroit does lose the game, but they lost the game. This is the one great thing about baseball. Dick McAuliffe, from a Connecticut native, many people will know that, is a pesky second baseman. He stepped to the plate in the ninth inning of that game, having not hit into one double play all year. Not one. Man on first. Guess what he did?
Hits into a double play.
Of course, that's baseball. So the Red Sox win. And I was there as a spectator, I was for many of the games that summer. Had purchased my tickets about 6 weeks in advance. And I was down at Fenway doing a lunch hour for my job, and I saw that there were tickets available on the last day of the season. I said, well, that might be nice.
Imagine doing that today.
A couple of box seats, and my then-girlfriend, now my wife of 46 years, and went to – went for, 45, excuse me – went to – well, I think we'll make it to 46 – went to the game together and sat behind a box seat down a third baseline and watched that game.
You know, listening to those voices there, I think that was Ken Coleman we were listening to.
That was Mel Parnell.
Mel Parnell. Sorry about that. You're absolutely right. But it brings it back for me, too. I was only 10 or 11, but that's where I first dialed in to the Red Sox. Mm-hmm. You write about that 1967 season as the most important season of your
greatest fan experience I ever had. That includes
anything
I had in prep school, anything I had in college at Boston College, and anything I've had since that summer. That was the greatest fan experience. This city, remember, baseball had kind of fallen away after Ted Williams retired. And the Red Sox, in 1965, drew 650,000 people.
Yeah.
In 1966, there was a surge of interest all the way up to 900,000. Now they're in this pennant race, the first time they've really been in the race after the 4th of July since 1950. Okay. Mm. And the town recaptured its love of baseball. And believe me, Fenway was no iconic place in those days. It wasn't what my great friend Clark Booth called the baseball basilica yet. Mm-hmm. It was more like the old sofa at Grandma's house.
Right.
And Tom Yawkey wanted to replace it. He desperately wanted to get
out.
Wanted desperately to get out of Fenway Park. But the people rekindled their love of baseball, that team. So those people that these current owners can never thank enough for creating the whole circumstance that culminated in what they now have. They have to thank Carl Yastrzemski, Jim Lomborg, Rico Petrocelli, Dick Williams et al. For everything that they have today.
Well, let's jump forward a little bit to 2004. And, of course, this is the Red Sox win finally after 86 years. You wrote this in this section of the book, which I loved. When people ask me to choose my favorite moments from my 46 years at the Globe, I always explain that in the case of baseball, it's not one game or one event, but a combination. And you talk about those two great games in the 2004 ALCS, mm-hmm. Boston against New York. The Red Sox were down 3-0, and of course they went on to win eight games in a row. But we have 10 hours and 51 minutes of spectacular baseball all played on one day.
That's
right?
Correct, because the first game started at game four started at 5 p.m. It's in the twilight, and then it wound up going past midnight, and the second game started. Oh, the first game was a night game, went after midnight.
Right.
The second game, game five, started at 5 p.m.
Right.
So the first game ended, game four ended after midnight, and therefore both games were played and ended on ended on the same day. That famous ninth inning, the Red Sox down, the great Mariano Rivera, Kevin Millar draws a walk, Dave Roberts comes in, the entire Western world knows he has to steal second base, and then Bill Miller slaps one.
Bang play.
It was a great throw on a great jump, a great throw by Posada, a very depth, artful swipe tag by Derek Jeter, who stole many out with that beautiful maneuver, but umpire Joe West got it right.
Yeah.
The replay did verify that he was safe. And then Bill Miller hit the ball up the middle, which Mariano Rivera nearly caught and kicked at. He will tell you he,
that's right,
kicked,
he looked like a goalie
kicked
doing
at it.
Yeah, right.
Well, then we go all the way to the 14th inning, and Poppy hits a home run off of Paul Quantrill. And then the game five was another epic, and Poppy wins that one with a bloop single on like the 10th pitch at bat. And but the drama of it. And remember, Kevin Millar kept saying, "Don't let us win. Don't let us win game four. Don't let us win."
But you know who else seemed to pick up on that? I may have imagined this. So I was there for NPR, both on game four and game five. And I went into the Yankee press conference. Joe Torre was there. Mm-hmm. And the Yankees still had a 3-1 lead. Mm-hmm. They still had another game to play in Boston and two more in New York if necessary. So, you know, I'm still sort of cynical and saying, yeah, it's okay. The Red Sox are going to at least be carried out on their shields, but there's no way they're going to win this. That was my attitude. But Joe Torre looked really pensive and said, you know, momentum can shift really quickly in a short series.
Well,
and I'm wondering if he
respected the rivalry in the Red Sox very much, and I don't know whether he knew, felt he had a gut feeling that was or what, but that's interesting to hear that. I know that I just know from the other side, the Red Sox attitude after game three was, well, we've won four in a row before, and it was Millar. Kevin Millar was the driving force, the spirit of that whole bunch. Mm. There's no question that he was the one who pumped people up and made everybody else think that it was possible.
Well, I've got to sort of jump forward. Yeah. I mean, we've got to talk very quickly because our time is running out about this awful season that just ended. What's your analysis of what happened? The Red Sox go from first to worst. And I've got to ask you this. So they win the World Series in 2013. Then just a few months later, they unload a large piece of that championship roster. Has that ever happened? Four pitchers, two or three regular
players?
Well,
it happened willingly in history. And when Connie Mack twice broke up A's teams for financial reasons back in after 1914 and 1931. But no, now we move to the modern time. The decisions were made that did not turn out well. Just as last year, Ben Cherington's decisions were universally excellent. He signed seven free agents, and they all turned out to be contributors. This year, he signed A.J. Pierzynski. It just didn't go well. He invested faith in rookies, Jackie Bradley Jr. and Xander Bogaerts. And, of course, Bradley never hit. Bogaerts hit sporadically and not at all in the middle of the year. They pitched well enough to stay in a race. What they did not do, and here's the reason, the answer, they did not bring people home. They got enough people on base to win a very fair percentage of games, did not hit well in the clutch, did not bring them home. Period. Mm. That was the big reason.
That was the big reason. Well, Bob Ryan, it's such a pleasure talking to you. There's so much more I'd like to talk to you about, but we're out of time. But thank you for coming in. Come back, please.
I would love to. Thanks for having me.
So that's Bob Ryan, the veteran Boston Globe sports writer and columnist. His new memoir is called Scribe, My Life in Sports, and he'll be appearing at the Prudential Center Barnes & Noble tomorrow at 12:30. Stay with us. Coming up, do you underestimate the ordinary moments in your life? If you do, turns out you're not alone. I'm Anthony Brooks with Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.